You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, December 16th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. We're tired, ladies and gentlemen. We're battered. We're broken. But we're here reviewing the fifth or the tenth, depending on how you decide to count, Republican presidential primary debate in Las Vegas last night with the great Charlie Pierce, politics writer for Esquire magazine. Also on the program today, budget deal struck. We'll head to a vote tomorrow in the House. Some good, some bad, some sort of like just ridiculous. Just days after a landmark international agreement on cutting carbon emissions, this budget deal will necessarily raise them at a rate far greater than one could have anticipated. I'll tell you why later. Also on the program today, Jeb Bush setting a record for the least effective spending of millions of dollars in campaign ads. And this, I don't know, just breaking, but this clarification just breaking. The FBI says the San Bernardino attackers didn't show public support for jihad on social media. To the extent that there was anything there, it was in private comments that they made to the wife, Malik, made to friends back in 2012 and 2013. It's pre-ISIS days, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, come on. Give me a break. You know, the FBI is so politically correct.
And also breaking, Michael Brooks.
Just losing it just because Ben Carson is going
cannot
away.
Cannot handle.
I know.
Ben
I'm
Carson
miss you.
Fading into the sunset.
Did you make a Holocaust comparison to Bounce Back or something,
people
please?
People still do impressions of John Wayne, and he's been dead for years.
True.
Do you know who I'm talking about?
No,
John Wayne?
Of course not.
Right, there you go. So, ladies and gentlemen, we have posted, as of now, am I right, Matt? We have posted the full Republican debate from last night.
For members.
For members, with our commentary, for members only at this point. We will eventually, I believe, get around to sharing it with all the free beers. But the public people get it up front. Now, we did have, 20,000 views of our coverage last night on YouTube. And we'll leave that up for a little bit, too. We may leave that up for, I don't know. But members will get the audio delivered directly into their heads. We are actually testing out something which will bypass any of your devices, and it will just be there. It will just live there forever. We don't. That's the one downside. We don't know how to get it out.
Hi, I'm Sam Cedar. I'm in your head now.
There you go.
I have thoughts on Medicaid, yes. Medicare, Social Security, and my wife.
Sadly, so we have haven't quite figured out the compression issue that makes my voice sound like that when we put it into your brain. So sadly, that's one of the downsides.
I mean, we're still Sam working. As
it's
I
new
hear
technology.
Him for your brain.
Right. It's new technology that we're instituting. All right. We're going to take a quick break. Just a reminder, folks, it is your membership that makes this show possible. Hey, if you want to get, we got an email asking, how do I gift a Majority Report membership? And, to be honest with you, we've never worked that out. Soon we're going to have a system, I think, that's going to allow us to do that sort of automatically. But for now, what you can do is send us an email. We do 6 month gifts or we do year-long gifts. Or I suppose we could do like a five-year gift if you really wanted to. But 6 month gift, 1 year gifts, just send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will hook you up if you want to gift the show. Or you can just make a gift yourself by being a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. Send that as a gift. That's a great gift. And then you give people the coupon, too, and it's like two gifts for the price of one minus 10%. That's two gifts for the price of 90% of one, for 9/10 of one. And, of course, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Majorityreportkickback.com. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, the great Charlie Pierce from Who's Roots in Worcester. We'll be right back. We are back. All right, folks. Best laid plans. Charlie Pierce is not going to be joining us, sadly. He is sick as a dog.
And the Republicans made him ill.
The Republicans made him physically ill, but he sends his regards. And Michael will do his impersonation.
Yeah, it was. That was a really intense debate, bro.
No, that's not. That's
Charlie Pierce has become a bro dude from Worcester. No. It would be amazing if you read his Esquire columns, which are very funny and very literary and very sophisticated. And then on each interview, he'd be like, yeah, I mean, Marco Rubio looked like he was just, had no idea what he was doing up there, dude.
Well, that is actually, I think, what
God.
He wrote. All right. Well, let's
break it down.
We'll break it down.
He did really vouch for him.
Yes.
He sounded
like it literally woke
ill.
Him up. And yeah. He sounded so sick, he didn't even sound like he was from Massachusetts.
No, he's just like, I can't do this. The world is ending.
Yeah, I woke him up.
He was in physical proximity to Ted Cruz and the spiritual toxins.
I got him on the phone, and it took a couple of times, and I got him on the phone, and he answered. I'm like, Charlie? He's like, yeah. I'm like, did I wake you? And he goes, yeah.
He sounded a little masked when he was like, who's this? He did break out a little bit.
Yeah.
In fairness, it's only 9 in Las Vegas. So.
Well, that's not that early.
Hey, man, to be fair, it is only 9 o'clock. It's pretty early, man. To be honest with you,
the debate ended in Las Vegas at 8:30 p.m.
I would prefer to be listening to a book on tape right now myself, man.
Did he have to file something afterward?
Yeah, he did.
Yes, that would lengthen.
Yeah, he dictates
time.
A blog into his phone. Whatever.
Yeah, come on, give
get
me
out
a
of
break.
Here.
God, you know, there was a story. I used to do in comedy, and we'll get to the debate in a second. But a comedian I knew in Boston who was older than I was, he was a couple of generations older than me, a guy named Frank Santorelli, who was one of the characters in The Sopranos for a while. He was one of the guys that worked at the bar. And
is he the guy that Tony throws the phone at when he messes up the transferring the call or something? Is that guy?
It may be.
Oh, that would be awesome if you knew that guy. Okay,
I think so. He's sort of like
big
a teddy
dude.
Big, but a teddy
a
bear.
Big
face.
Teddy bear. Sorry, Tone.
Yeah, I think that was him. And I got to double check on that. But and apparently they tried to renegotiate. But there's a problem with people who come from Boston. They think they become huge stars in like 30 seconds. And then they inevitably, there was a comedian who did the same thing. And she had her own show and it fell apart. And then she went on Murphy Brown. And on the first day, gave Candace Bergen a line read after Candace Bergen and was fired summarily. And
I don't think you got that, Candace.
Years ago, when Santorelli was commenting on Anthony, not Anthony Clark, but there was another Anthony who was a sitcom actor who had a couple of. It was Anthony. No, I can't remember his last name now. But he was talking about how he didn't like the shows he was doing. And Santorelli had this quote that I carried around my wallet for a long time when I was trying to justify doing sitcoms to myself. Something like, yeah, you don't like doing a sitcom? Go cry in your money. something like that. But I don't even know why I thought about that. All right. Let's get to the debate. Let's do the serious stuff. Michael, help me out here. We're gonna break this down. Let's take it from the serious to the sublime, the parts that were really, really enjoyable.
So you mean 30 seconds
because,
on the serious and
well,
25
no,
on the sublime?
Because I think it's worthwhile having a little more because, you know, there was definitely some stuff that happened during the debate that was relevant. Let me just say this. In terms of the campaign, or I should say in terms of like the horse race, I don't think this changes anything. And to the extent that it changes anything, I would say that Rubio did not do what he had to do to be the guy that they keep claiming he is. And, you know, Cruz was incredibly confident. Rubio, I have a theory now. This is what my theory is with Rubio and Cruz. And like I say, I think it's going to be mostly static. And this has huge implications for us as normal people living in the country. Because there's a freak show, ladies and gentlemen, that represents nearly half of the country. And we're going to talk about the budget deal today. And you will see the implications of that freak show in our daily lives, in the lives of our children going forward, in the climate. And so this stuff, while it's fun to mock them, who ends up being the presidential candidate for the Republican Party means a real lot. It means a real lot. And I'm not saying electoral politics is the end-all be-all, or that legislative politics, at least in the short run, is the end-all be-all. But they're important. You can almost think of it as a triad, but we'll get to that in a minute. This is the way, I mean, and I, you know, have been saying for a while that I think Cruz could end up being the guy, and certainly nothing that happened last night dispelled me of that notion. I think he's on some type of medication. There's just no way you go through a debate for 2 hours and get that kind of dry mouth. It's not nerves at that point. You've been on stage for too long. I've been involved in too many performances to know and been nervous in these situations that, like, you don't have that level of dry mouth at the end of that debate when you've got bottles of water underneath. It's just not possible unless there's medication involved. And when I look at Rubio, like, it's not too hard to see, and this is all armchair bullshit analysis, I get it, but the guy looks scared to me, you know, because you put him next to Cruz and it's like, if you've ever played any sports, you know, there are two types of people who play out in baseball, or not only two, but there's the guy who's like, I want the ball to be hit to me. In any situation, I want the ball to be hit to me. I want the ball to be hit to me so badly that I'm willing to stand in front of the pitcher and let the guy take a full swing just so I got a better shot of getting the ball, even if it smacks me in the face. And then there's the guy, and this is what and that to me is Cruz. And then there's Rubio, who, when they're warming up and they're throwing in the infield, he's got beautiful form. He looks great. He's got the nice, like, pants, and he's got his socks pulled all the way up, and he just looks like a baseball player. But as soon as the ball is hit to him, he bobbles it every time because he's shitting his pants. Excuse me. Pooping his pants. and that to me looks like Rubio, because look.
Which is not helpful for his dry mouth.
I think he's got the classic 70s metaphor, fear of flying. I think he is really afraid of being like in that situation. And I think the guy probably has like massive anxiety attacks. And I'm not knocking that. Most of the people I know have anxiety attacks. But I think this guy is medicated. And I think it's just keeping him, a little bit flatlined. And it's giving him dry mouth. Now, this couldn't be any greater BS, armchair analysis than that. But that was just the sense I had during the debate. Now, let's get on to the more substantive stuff.
I was just going to say, I think regardless of the cause, I think that even the sense in which Rubio sort of throws the ball well, to continue carrying that analogy or metaphor, I mean, I think it just is, again, another illustration of how weak the field is, because he's really not that great. I mean, people are so insistent on talking about how articulate he is and how this and that, and it's like, yeah, I mean, he's fine, but so much of that is just relative to how weak the communication skills are in the field relative to that quote-unquote moderate position. I mean, Cruz and Trump are extremely effective communicators, but they're doing something entirely different. But just in terms of like having I keep thinking of John Edwards with Marco Rubio. I just think it's, and if anything,
Mark, yeah, but John Edwards was actually much more polished, much more confident, much stronger.
Absolutely. But I think.
But I also think from a political standpoint, look, I mean, from a political standpoint, Rubio also made some massive mistakes here. Like his extremism on abortion, and it is extremism. I mean, it is extremism, even for the Republican Party. What lane is he trying to fill there, right? You know, I mean, that's going to hurt him from the establishment perspective.
You know who he actually reminds me of? Harold Ford. Remember Harold Ford?
Yes.
I think that just in the sense that when you're so slick, you're not slick. And I think that even the way in which he chose that to take that incredibly extreme position on abortion is, I mean, it's obviously calculated.
It's bad politics. It's a poor calculation.
It doesn't work. I mean, it's not like, that was so devious and savvy. It was just like, that's bizarre and craven.
Well, but I mean, when he does that, though, he's putting himself into a lane with Ben Carson and Ted Cruz. And that's not his lane, supposedly.
Right.
But he has to do that because he's trying to make up for the fact that he was part of the Gang of Eight. And in the immigration deal, and that has alienated. This is getting into the sort of stuff that I think is like is a little bit too clever by half. But nevertheless, you know, the politics of it and this and that. At the end of the day, all of the stuff that we're saying can be brought back to that the Bachman principle, and the Bachman principle is, of course. When Michelle Bachman gave that first Tea Party, which is really just another way of saying Republican base, Tea Party address, not a rebuttal to the State of the Union. I think this was in 2010, I think it was. Maybe it was 2009, but I'm pretty sure it was 2010. You had the Republican response, and then you had the Tea Party response. And Michelle Bachmann gave this response. They had a closed circuit camera for the Tea Party that went into, like, I guess, stadiums or conference halls or VFW halls or who knows where. And they had a CNN camera, and they were both on her. But as I will demonstrate for the camera here that we use for YouTube, if this camera, the one I'm pointing to, is the CNN camera, she looked 6 inches to the right on the Tea Party camera and talked directly to camera, except her eyes were just drifting off. Her eye line was just off enough. And she looked insane. Just forget about what she was saying. She looked like an insane person to the rest of the country. And that is the dilemma these Republicans will always have. You cannot talk to the Tea Party and look sane to the rest of the country. And if you look to the rest of the country, you look insane to the Tea Party.
And just real quick, I would say if you're inspired by Sam's Marco Rubio theory, tweet it to Donald Trump.
There you go.
See if that gets picked up.
See if he gets picked up. All right, but let's talk.
Before you guys get serious, I just want to point out that you all have failed to mention that Rubio is the cutest one.
I think the same analysis would apply, though. Like, cute compared to what?
I'm not sure that it's an analysis. It's just an observation.
Do you not find Ted Cruz attractive at all?
No, I texted Matt during the debate last night when they were doing a split screen between Cruz and Rubio. I was like, oh, my God, Rubio's the best-looking man alive, and now I'm going to vote for him.
Yeah, you got to take a look at his ears. Those are quite large.
You got to, like, stop having Republican debate Stockholm syndrome.
You said that I had Stockholm syndrome because I was only comparing. They're the only people in my universe.
Right.
So let's get to the interesting part about this. You had... Last night, I mean, it was ostensibly, I don't know what the selling point of the debate was. Keep America safe. And we're going to do that by not talking about Afghanistan. We're going to do that not by mentioning Yemen. We're going to do that not by talking about...
Yemen. That's like the advanced course, man. Fair.
Global warming.
Fake.
We're not going to talk about the rash of mass gun shootings. If it was perpetrated by anybody but a Muslim, et cetera, et cetera. So we're going to stay very limited. And in some ways that helped us, I think, be more funny because there wasn't that sense that we need to listen to this after the first like 30 minutes because they kept going over the exact same ground over and over again. But what was very clear was that there is a substantial split, at least on that stage, not quite half and half. There was 9 people on the stage, but I think at least three people in there are non-interventionists who were arguing against regime change. I would include Trump in this.
Yeah.
And Ted Cruz.
Ted Cruz definitely made that
break. And Rand Paul was the most vocal about it and the most articulate. Now, look, I think Rand Paul is largely a joke insofar as his libertarian ideas of markets and freedom and gold or whatever it is. You know, there's a couple of positions he has, you know, that we need more transparency at the Fed. And I think at the very least in how he articulated foreign policy last night that I tend to agree with. The foreign policy that he was articulating last night was not really distinguishable from what people, if they're looking at Bernie Sanders, would call a socialist. foreign policy. Now, I don't know that Bernie Sanders has socialist foreign policy per se.
No, I don't.
But
think so.
He is a he is a democratic, self-avowed democratic socialist. I'm just saying, you know, because I know that we're going to have somebody call in the fun half of the program and say, "Hey, I guess you're a libertarian," and we're sure. No, libertarians do not own the idea or have an exclusive ownership of the idea that foreign intervention and regime change is good policy, and that it wouldn't be better to invest the money at home. I mean, look, let's play this clip of, do we have this clip of Trump? This one where he says on
spending money for
yeah, do
war
we don't
at
have
home.
This? Do we have that? Okay, let's play this clip because Donald Trump talking about essentially our invasion and occupation of Iraq. And listen to this clip and tell me that even Dennis Kucinich would have had a problem with this back in 2004. Go ahead, play this clip.
Mr. Trump, are Americans safer with dictators running the world in the Middle East?
In my opinion...
Go ahead, Mr. Trump.
In my opinion, we've spent $4 trillion trying to topple various people that, frankly, if they were there and if we could have spent that $4 trillion in the United States to fix our roads, our bridges, and all of the other problems, our airports, and all of the other problems we have, we would have been a lot better off. I can tell you that right now. We have done a tremendous disservice, not only to the Middle East, we've done a tremendous disservice to humanity. The people that have been killed, the people that have been wiped away, and for what? It's not like we had victory. It's a mess. The Middle East is totally destabilized, a total and complete mess. I wish we had the $4 trillion or $5 trillion. I wish it was spent right here in the United States on our schools, hospitals, roads, airports, and everything else that are all falling apart.
Thank you. Wow, that is exactly what President Obama said.
And Carly Fiorina jumps in there and says that's exactly what President Obama said. And I have to say, God help me, I don't know if there's a single word in what he just said there that I don't totally agree with. I mean, the only thing that as I read that is when he says it's not like we had a victory, as if that's really the issue. But beyond that, I don't think there is a single word in that. And that is that is the guy who is now garnering 40% of the Republican primary field. Now, I don't think they listen to that any more than they listen to what he says about Rosie O'Donnell. I think they just like the fact that he says it with a certain amount of bravado, and the guy's a billionaire, and so whatever he says goes. But that's quite good. And, you know, Rand Paul was saying stuff not quite in the same fashion. I don't think he was saying that he would spend that money on infrastructure. I think he would rather, I don't know, charity or, you know, private toll roads or whatever, some silliness, or we all get our own court system or whatever it is. But nevertheless, the idea that we shouldn't be going around in terms of attempting to overthrow other governments, because it's very difficult to look back and find a single example of one where we have militarily intervened to overthrow a government and it worked. I mean, I guess you could say like the former Yugoslavia, things aren't great now there, but there isn't like sort of the ongoing killing that was taking place when we intervened. And we may have had other, you know, other intentions or other reasons for that intervention. But aside from that, where we were stopping ongoing killing, and I don't know how directly we certainly accelerated the pace of an overthrow there. But beyond that, I can't think of a single circumstance where things have worked out well.
I think though the difference, which I would like at some point to see Bernie Sanders maybe speak more to, he has a little bit, is that you sort of have this establishment debate, which is basically neoconservative versus neoliberal, and that's sort of the Hillary versus the Republican establishment. It's both very interventionist, but I would say on Hillary's side, it's slightly more respectful of international institutions, and it's also pays a little bit more lip service and attention to development goals and getting and you know poverty and things like that. And then this sort of more isolationist position of someone like Rand Paul. I would like to see Bernie talk, speak about the interventionism, but also talk about, yeah, what would a socialist foreign policy look like? And I think to some degree it would be addressing global inequality. It would be talking about, and he does, but even more so about the human rights implications of some of the trade deals that he critiques.
Right.
I think there's a whole other realm that you could get into. And, you know, he's not going to go to this, but in the 80s when he was mayor of Burlington, he went and spent time with the Sandinistas. That is, in fact, a socialist foreign policy. He was going out and actively saying, in contrast to Reagan policy, we support people's right to determine their own governments in Latin America, which we have not as a matter of U.S. policy for decades, obviously. So I think it'd be great if he borrowed a little bit more of the Lincoln Chafee message, actually, which is really ironic that the, like, you know, Rockefeller Republican was the guy articulating a progressive foreign policy. But there's room for that because no one's articulating that.
Let's hear Rand Paul also hit the notion of regime change, because you have to understand the way that this, and we don't have that sound, do we, the of each, the intro from each person? Yeah, I mean, we don't have like an assemblage, right? A montage.
Oh, no, okay. I'll put that
That's
together.
All right, don't worry about it. So at the beginning of the debate, every person had their opening statement. And I don't know, it's all a bit of a blur to me, but at least three or four of them started off with some variant of, we're in World War III, or we are under attack, or we are in a war of civilizations.
Moment of silence.
And then... Ben Carson wanted a moment of silence. I'm surprised. I say, to his credit, he didn't take a moment of silence throughout the debate. I thought that was what he was going to do. Every time you come to me, a moment of silence.
I'd also like a moment of silence.
So let's get to
the shortest moment of silence.
Yeah, it was really short. When he heard people laughing at him, I think is when he realized I should probably move on and pretend like I know the answer to this.
Working.
But here's Rand Paul talking about regime change, which is pretty stunning, because the way that debate started, you would think that this debate was being held in an underground bunker and it was secretly being disseminated to everybody, like, you know, The Man in the High Castle or whatever that show is, where, like, nobody's supposed to know we're having this debate because we're under such siege. Wolverines.
Was getting rid of Saddam Hussein a pretty good deal?
These are the fundamental questions of our time, these foreign policy questions, whether or not regime change is a good idea or a bad idea. I don't think, because I think the regime change was a bad idea, it means that Hussein was necessarily a good idea. There's often variations of evil on both sides of the war. What we have to decide is whether or not regime change is a good idea. It's what the neoconservatives have wanted. It's what the vast majority of those on the stage want. They still want regime change. They want it in Syria. They wanted it in Iraq. They wanted it in Libya. It has not worked. Out of regime change, you get chaos. From the chaos, you've seen repeatedly the rise of radical Islam. So we get this profession of, oh my goodness, they want to do something about terrorism. And yet they're the problem, because they allow terrorism to arise out of that chaos.
And thank you, Senator.
And that got, a good response. I mean, don't go by too much what you hear in these crowds. I mean, one of the things that I've noticed is that the crowds tend to be very forum-specific. Venetian Hotels, owned by Sheldon Adelson. I think also the Republican establishment probably made sure that they got the type of crowd they wanted. If you remember in California when they had that crowd out there, Carly Fiorina seemed like everybody loved what she was saying. And then you realize, oh, she's in California. Literally everyone in that room was probably made up her the entire amount of people who voted for her in her losing bid for Senate. And so you got to take that with a grain of salt. But it's good to hear that on a Republican debate stage. And let's be honest, between Ted Cruz and Donald Trump and Rand Paul, even if he's bringing in 3 points, 4 points, the majority of those three people combined control the majority of people, at least in terms of the polling right now, in the Republican Party.
I think even if you're a Republican, as delusional as they are, they have to on some level get that not only is it alarmist and delusional how much they inflate that threat, but that there's nothing, it's basic deduction. This has never worked. So even if you accept that crisis level and you have any ability to think, then you have to get to the next step, which is what created this mass crisis? The same policies that you're advocating, just repeating again and again and again.
Here's what's fascinating about this. If you imagine a scenario where Hillary Clinton is the Democratic presidential nominee, and one of those three that we just mentioned, Rand Paul's not going to be, but Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, I think it would be irrational for you not to put most of the money you're going to bet on this on one of those two guys.
Assume it's one of them.
They arguably could be to the left of the Democratic nominee in terms of broad aspects of foreign policy. I mean, they will both talk about, you know, they'll both say the words, whatever the magic words are. I can't, Muslim jihadism, extremism. But the fact of the matter is, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz will hit Hillary Clinton not just on her Iraq vote, but they could hit her on things like Libya, and they could hit her on her desire to bomb Syria. I mean, they could be to the left of Hillary Clinton on these topics.
That said, I think it is important to note, because we shouldn't talk about this debate without at least acknowledging the fact that Wolf Blitzer asked questions that almost presupposed war crimes, frankly, as sort of being acceptable, almost. And Ted Cruz I don't think it hurts them in a Republican debate at all. But the point I'm making is that in a general election, even if they're substantively running to the left in some respects from Hillary, it's still worth noting that they're both threatening explicitly action that would amount to, you know, mass indiscriminate slaughter of civilians.
What are you talking about?
Well, when Ted Cruz, what did he say? Let's see if the sand glows in the Middle East.
Yeah, carpet bombing.
He talked about carpet bombing them.
That's right.
When Donald
That's
Trump
right.
talks about bombing oil convoys, if anybody has any memory of when Saddam Hussein actually did that in Kuwait during the Gulf War, the consequences of those things are truly grotesque. So
absolutely.
But
I think in terms of, like, broadly speaking, in terms of foreign policy, you know, you could say from a tactical standpoint what they would do would be misguided, or would even in some narrow instances promote more casualties. But the fact of the matter is Hillary Clinton favors regime change much more easily than either one of those two guys, and that's just the reality. Now, you know, sad to say, I'm not convinced that's a liability for her in a general election. Because certainly when Wolf Blitzer asked the questions of those two candidates, if it's, let's say, Hillary and Trump or Hillary and Ted Cruz, Wolf Blitzer is going to be more aligned with Hillary Clinton's perspective. I mean, that's just
and
where
she'll also just sort of more broadly sound like she knows what she's talking about.
Well, yes,
yeah,
so I'm just
but
talking
you're
though
right.
where
yeah.
you place this on the spectrum. She is more interventionist than they are.
No doubt.
Yeah, but she actually knows what she's talking about.
Well, Well, first of all, I'm not sure I know on what grounds you're talking about in that. She may have more information, but her prescription could still be worse.
her worldview has not evolved from all these disasters. And in a sense, that's more disturbing from anything.
So, yeah. I just wanted to point that out. It's a fascinating thing to contemplate. Would I think it have any electoral impact? No. I think, largely speaking...
With Trump, it might, in a minimal way, because we've talked about Trump potentially appealing to a sort of Reagan Democrat to the extent they still exist. If he fuses a campaign of a sort of populism with a critique of those foreign policy things, I don't think he'll win. But I actually think if I was a Republican and really trying to think strategically about how to beat someone like Hillary Clinton, a message like that on crony capitalism and elites and in more non-interventionist foreign policy delivered by somebody who wasn't Donald Trump would be pretty threatening.
Yeah, maybe. But only Donald Trump, really, in many respects, can deliver that for them. So it's just it's more of interest than I think it's going to have any real implications in the general election, regardless. All right, let's go to to prove Kelly's point. Kelly has just suggested that even if it's the case that Donald Trump has a more palatable view of intervention than, say, someone like Hillary Clinton, one thing is clear. Donald Trump has no idea what he's talking about. And this question about nuclear proliferation from Hugh Hewitt, there is a longstanding U.S. Doctrine, I guess you could say, or a strategic doctrine on the use of nuclear weapons, that there are three elements: by sea, by land, or by air. I mean, this is pretty basic stuff.
Doesn't take a genius to figure this out.
Right. But, do you deliver these nukes via a submarine? Do you deliver it by intercontinental missiles? Or do you deliver it by large planes, let's say? And at any given time through our, the past 60 or 70 years, there have been different theories as to what is strategically the best way to deliver these nuclear weapons as sort of. So Hugh Hewitt trying to prove that Donald Trump is not able to be presidential material brings this up without realizing that no one in the Republican Party gives a crap about policy competence. It just is a fig leaf that people are just not buying. And but here's Donald Trump doing his best to avoid answering the question directly. Count how many different things he brings up that are not with what he's talking about. In fact, I'll ding my cup every time there's something that has absolutely nothing to do with what the question was. Okay, play this.
Mr. Trump, Dr. Carson just referenced the single most important job of the president, the command, the control, and the care of our nuclear forces. And he mentioned the triad. The B-52s are older than I am. The missiles are old. The submarines are aging out. It's an executive order. It's a commander-in-chief decision. What's your priority among our nuclear triad?
Well, first of all, I think we need somebody absolutely that we can trust, who's totally responsible, who really knows what he or she is doing, that is so powerful and so important. And one of the things that I'm frankly most proud of is that in 2003, 2004, I was totally against going into Iraq because you're going to destabilize the Middle East. I called it. I called it very strongly, and it was very important. But we have to be extremely vigilant and extremely careful when it comes to nuclear. Nuclear changes the whole ballgame. Frankly, I would have said, get out of Syria, get out. If we didn't have the power of weaponry today, the power is so massive that we can't just leave areas that 50 years ago or 75 years ago, we wouldn't care. It was hand-to-hand combat. The biggest problem this world has today is not President Obama with global warming, which is inconceivable. This is what he's saying. The biggest problem we have today is nuclear proliferation, and having some maniac, having some madman go out and get a nuclear weapon. That's, in my opinion, that is the single biggest problem that our country faces
Of the
right
three
now.
Legs of the triad, though, do you have a priority? Because I want to go to Senator Rubio
To me, nuclear is just the power, the devastation is very important to me.
It's So there you have it. So listen, folks, take that, study that tape. If you're ever on a job interview and you have no idea what how to answer, Donald Trump just gave you the perfect game plan. You just got to hope that you only have 2 minutes to answer the question. In fact, what you should do is say, you know what? That's a great question. Do you have an egg timer? Just give me 2 minutes. Let me 2 minutes. That way you can run the clock out. And
I thought that was actually more of a, like, I haven't done the reading type of thing. You know, it's just like, oh, the chapter, you ask. Well, right. Indeed. The
Mr. Iliad Cedar,
is a rather could you please serious tell us, yes, book of great import to the Greeks, among others. Is this books, a book we read?
Books are very, very important for people. First off, they read them. It is also a way in which people learn things.
But yeah, no question. The Iliad, huge book. Big deal.
Oh,
bottom line, reading the Iliad, good.
And then Rubio rushes in like, looking at our P-52 bombers, they are 50 years old. In fact, our nuclear submarines, the capacity that we have from our nuclear class submarines.
And then
are,
what do? We go, ooh, look at the brains on Marco. You a smart motherfucker, Marco. Would you care for some of my Sprite to wash down your cotton mouth?
Did Trump say somewhere in there that he... He mentioned it being important for there to be an extremely important person. Like he just called himself.
Person. Oh yeah, you gotta be. It's gotta be. No, it's an important person.
An extremely powerful and important person. I think that's what he said. That's what he was talking about.
You know what
himself.
I love is I love Kelly try because it makes no sense. So when you're trying to string an actual recap of what he said,
I know. I'm sorry.
It's exactly. It sounds like gibberish. She's like, I'm trying to remember exactly what he said. He was like, there needs to be someone important, but powerful. You also trust them and they're powerful. And it's like, yes. Exactly. Nailed it.
That's sort of like trying to make sense of that stuff. You know, I spoke to someone today who said like they were watching the debate with their wife, and their wife doesn't watch debates on a regular basis.
Good for her.
And she was like, what the frick is going on? What? Who? What are these people talking about? Like if, you know, we're so in the mix of this that, you know, we're somewhat... We're just not shocked by it. But I think like people coming to this, you didn't remember, like even the biggest debate of the of years, 25 million people, there's still probably like, you know, another 50 million people out there in the country who are, you know, fairly intelligent people,
you know,
who are just like sort of not aware of what these Republican candidates say.
You know, that sort of reminds me of is one of my ex-girlfriends who was like, she was at, you know, she was studying international relations, very smart. But we were watching Bill Maher, and this was when Breitbart was still alive, and he was on a panel, and she looks at me, she goes, who the hell is this guy? People read and watch him?
Yes.
And I just was like, yeah.
Yes. All right.
And I envied that she had never heard of him.
I guess we should go into the fun half of the program now. We've got to wrap it up relatively early today. So we've got more. We're going to talk about... Chris Christie being the World War III candidate. Ben Carson had two fantastic moments in the debate, which I think actually make up sort of like 45% of his actual speaking time.
No, and I thought he was actually really surprisingly impressive, and I think everybody should give him a close look as a candidate.
He's so desperate. So desperate to... And then we're going to look at Jeb Bush's post-debate ad, which is just one of the funniest, like, this poor guy, man. Oh, we're going to pull a clip. There was one moment in the debate, and I wish we had that clip now, of our reacting to it. It just occurs to me, like, when Trump really just sort of, you know, manhandled Jeb, and Jeb just, you could see how seething, angry... Jeb was, and just so ineffectual.
That energy thing gets to him.
Ah, it's cold. Why don't you get done? Like you could just see him in his mind,
calling his mom and just going like, "Mom, what is going on? This is not right." He keeps doing that.
Would have never become
a thing.
Can you
please tell him to stop?
Not fair.
It's not fair. You can see, like, this guy was trained by George to get picked on. And, like, he doesn't know, like, he always brings himself back to that comfort position. All right, we're going to take a quick break, go into the fun half. We're going to play more of these clips. We'll talk about the budget deal. And, yeah, that's what's going to happen. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about the International Paris Agreement, which, you know, why bring that up in a debate? It only happened 3 or 4 days ago.
They were talking about serious issues, Sam. They don't have time for that
shit. Yeah, exactly. Wow. I understand. All right, we'll be right back. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM us. If you're leaving us, see you tomorrow. If you're not leaving us, see you in just seconds.